Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Just a reminder that this is a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking any calls. Well, it's been inspiring devotion for 75 years. Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12-step program developed by Bill Wilson, has helped many alcoholics get sober. More than a million people belong to one of AA's 55,000 meeting groups in the United States. But it turns out scientists and addiction experts don't really know why it works. And it doesn't work for everybody, but when it works, it's still somewhat of a mystery as to why. Is it the admission of powerlessness over alcohol, the submission to a higher power, or the power of the group that keeps people on the wagon? And while for some the devotion to AA is similar to their former devotion to alcohol, the vast majority of people who pass through AA will never even make it to their first anniversary of sobriety. So why does it work for some and not for others? Brendan Corner, contributing editor at Wired magazine, tried to find out, and he joins me now to talk about some of the theories on why AA's 12 steps persist. Hey, Brendan, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Brendan, the kind of devotion that people have to AA is, you know, as some have put it, similar to the kind of devotion they once had to alcohol, and that's by design. So first, for people unfamiliar with AA, maybe you can quickly explain the tenets of the system.
Yeah, sure. It actually stretches back to a revelation that Bill Wilson, the founder, had in December of 34 when he was detoxing in a facility here in New York. And he got down on his knees. He was agnostic, but he said, you know what, I've tried everything. I'm going to cry out to God for help. And if you're in this room, he said, he was in the hospital room, show yourself to me. And he had an epiphany, and he believed that God visited him in that room. And it was such a transformative experience for him. He felt that he had to go and minister to other alcoholics. The first couple of steps are all about acknowledging that your problem has you licked, has you beat, and that a higher power has to help you out of your situation. Then you go through a series of steps, which include enumerating your faults, sharing them with somebody else, finding those you've wronged and making amends to them, and ultimately doing good works and bringing the system to others.
Preston in Manhattan has been a member of AA. Hi, Preston. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Brian. Yes, I have been a member of AA for 18 years. I got sober in a rehab in Florida, and came back to New York, and I'm gay, and I found the gay groups in New York, the rooms we call them. And what's kept me sober is the fellowship, the other members. Everyone is just so incredibly supportive.
Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. You hear a lot of stories like that as you were researching your article, Brendan?
Certainly, you know, be in rooms, as the caller said, and you hear people saying that they've been going there for 20 years or more, and some people who would go every day still after a decade or more, some people going to multiple meetings per day, often when they're getting freshly sober. But you also have people who went frequently in the beginning of their sobriety and kind of fade away from regular attendance,
mm-hmm.
but still consider themselves working the steps every day of their lives.
And do you think what he heard, what he said is the most common thing that people say, that it's the fellowship? He made it sound like it's the ongoing, extremely supportive community that kind of replaces the alcohol in his life.
Well, that's exactly right. I think we're just starting to understand the importance of the social networks people develop in AA and in other anonymous groups that treat other sorts of addictions. You know, they're coming from environments many times where their bad behavior was encouraged, either tacitly or overtly, and they're replacing that with a social network where the number one priority is sobriety, and that's very, very important for people to have that strength and that power of the group to support them through the process.
Tom, in Port Monmouth, you're on WNYC as we talk about the 75th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I am happy to say this is my 20th year sober, and I got sober at 24. It took me 2.5 years of going to meetings to stop drinking. And I really think what changed me is I wanted to when I went to meetings, but I didn't have such a deep desire to really stop. I knew I wanted to, but it just wasn't at the level I needed to stop drinking. And my point is that I think it does work for anybody who really, really wants to.
You say it took you 2.5 years after you first joined AA to stop drinking. You don't have to be sober to go to meetings.
Absolutely not. And it's unfortunate sometimes you'll have some old-timers tell people, you know, maybe they should go out and drink and do some more research. But I think if you get to a meeting and you can get to a meeting, keep going to a meeting, because eventually something, I believe, at least from my experience and many others I've seen, something will click.
Tom, thanks.
I mean, it changed my life. And I never thought I was going to be one of these people talking like that. When I heard guys talk like me years ago, I used to curse them out under my breath vehemently.
Are you or were you when you started going religious? Is that a core element of it for you?
Absolutely not. In fact, I went to a Catholic grammar school, and I always say my mother was Catholic. I was just born. I was made to go to a Catholic grammar school, and I hated it, and I hated everything that had to do with religion. And one of the things that took me a long time to understand about AA specifically is that finding your higher power, it's individual, and you don't need to describe it or explain it to anybody else. It's all personal. So mine is, you know, the universal law of nature, you know.
So you were only born once.
Yes. Yes.
Tom, thank you for your call. We really appreciate it. So back to Brendan Koerner, contributing editor at Wired magazine, who went out looking for why AA works, which is still a mystery to many scientists, as well as why it doesn't work for those for whom it doesn't work. And to elaborate on the last point, Brendan, Erica on our comments page asks, what about the alcoholics that are avowed atheists? Is AA for them or not for them? Or I think some parallel organizations have sprung up that use the same kind of 12-step and community method, but without the religious component, correct?
Yeah, this is a real sticking point. This is why I think a lot of people who pass through AA are turned off by it. AA, you know, says that it's spiritual, not religious. But for a lot of people, that's just a matter of semantics, and those things are actually synonymous. And in the room, you will hear people talk about the importance of God in their lives in more perhaps overtly religious terms than some people are comfortable with. I certainly heard people talk specifically about Jesus Christ, and I would be in those rooms, and there would also be agnostics and atheists in those rooms who would hear people talking about the, you know, transformative process of believing in Jesus, and they'd roll their eyes, but they wouldn't get up and leave. They would just talk about the fact that for them, their higher power was not supernatural, but the higher power was perhaps the room itself or their sponsor or something that more tangible. I think it is perhaps more difficult for avowed agnostics and atheists to find their way through the organization, but they certainly do.
By the way, why is this a topic for Wired? How does this fit into your mission?
Well, I think that we came at it from the perspective of what's the science behind the system. That's part of it. I really wanted to understand the neuroscientific explanation for why AA works when it does work and how the steps operate. But secondly, I think that it's very interesting for us. You know, we are fascinated by tales of amateurs who come up with systems that seem to beat what the experts can concoct. And in AA and the 12 steps, you had a failed, you know, drunken stockbroker, Bill Wilson, who came up with a system that has really become our go-to solution for a range of addictions, not just alcoholism. There's Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, dozens of these groups. So I was fascinated by the question of how a rank amateur, a man with no medical expertise, could come up with a system that really, you know, at least matches what professional medical experts have concocted in the years since.
So in Wired terminology, you like an AA's approach to an open source code.
Well, I think the open source thing is key, and I talk about that in the piece. You know, that's been key to its growth. In the 1940s, you know, when AA was first taking off, there were a lot of questions within the organization of how to grow. And there were questions of, well, should we copyright the step? Should we open up treatment centers? And they ultimately chose, basically, as you say, open source, anarchy to a certain extent. There's anyone can found a meeting and use the 12 steps as their base code, but build on it to their heart's content.
Here is somebody who did not fall in love with AA. Brian in Brooklyn. Brian, thanks a lot for calling. You're on WNYC.
Sure. Yeah, my story is that I stopped at age 34 on the advice of a doctor, and seeking out folks who shared my behavioral abstinence, let's call it. I started going to meetings seriously about 11 or 12 years later. The novelty started to wear off fairly soon. And at 6 months, I said, what is going on here? And after 12 months, I ran from it screaming.
Did you find another way to get sober?
Doctor told me to stop drinking, and I stopped. It was quite that simple. And in terms of AA's success rate, I do know that the spontaneous cessation rate in the general public is about 5%. AA, based on its own, kind of dated, but I can't imagine much has changed, its own 1989 triennial survey said our success rate is about 5%. So in my very humble assessment of what's going on is the people who comprise the 5% in AA were going to quit anyway. So it's for some, I think I see it as a substitute addiction. The whole for that it tolerates atheists and agnostics to me doesn't make a lot of sense. In that you read Mr. Wilson's 12 and 12, it's called the 12 steps and 12 traditions, and by the time you read about the 11th and 12th step, you don't see any more references to God as you understand him. No, it's God with a capital G. So the whole thing has gotten watered down, but it gets watered down regionally,
right,
depending on I guess the religious tenor of the various geography.
But maybe that's a good thing because it can adapt to the needs of the local populations.
It's fine, but again, I mean, there's a certain inauthenticity when the preamble it says that the people who do hang around are capable of a constitutional honesty, I think it's called, those who leave there can't abide by. I mean, for starters, constitutional honesty. Bill Wilson was a proxy solicitor. He was not a stockbroker. He was a megalomaniac, if there ever was one. So the whole thing is just built on a mountain of myths. And there are old timers in the room, regardless what AA says, who will tell people, sponsors who are not trained professionals, who will tell people who are on antidepressant medication that they are not sober until they get off their medication. And there has to have been at least one suicide that AA, because it is anonymous, cannot answer for, but should. It has blood on its hands.
Brian, thank you for your call. What about Brandon, that question of antidepressants, they consider that not being sober if you're on a prescription antidepressant? Do you happen to know?
There's no official policy on that, but certainly the caller is correct in that, because there's no central quality control, there's tremendous variation in meetings. Meetings are often dominated by old-timers who, as the caller said, have very, very rigorous rules and kind of berate members who do use antidepressants. So, yes, that is a problem. There's over 50,000 meetings in the U.S., and each one's different. And some of them people have extremely negative reactions to due to misbehavior and domineering behavior by the leaders of the group. So that's a big problem.
And he mentioned a success rate, according to studies, of only 5%. And your article says there's such a huge range of purported, success rates, ranging anywhere from 5% to 75%, depending on who you ask.
Yeah, well, the 5% figure that the caller cited is actually a misreading of some data from AA, and it's just been repeated many, many times by critics of the organization. So it's not true. That said, my research did show that around 80% or more of people who try AA will not make it to their first anniversary. People do have very negative reactions to AA because of the religiosity, what they view as religiosity, because of the program is so rigorous. So it certainly does not work for the vast majority of people who try it. That's definitely true.
Now, here is Al in Manhattan who says he's been at it long enough to have known the founder, Bill Wilson, as we celebrate AA's 75th anniversary. Al, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you, and thank you for doing this show. Terrific. Yeah, I got sober in 1964 when I was 21 years old, went to a meeting here at 90th Street in Madison, which I'm going to be going to tonight. I think the success rate in AA is probably less than 2%. Otherwise, we'd be meeting at Yankee Stadium because thousands of people, thousands come through the doors of AA and dozens stay. I'm a lifelong atheist. I've never had any problem with the God business in AA. I just sort of tune it out. But I sat next to Bill Wilson at a long dinner party back in September of 69, and I said to him, Bill, you know, organizations come and they go, what do you think might be of such import, some power that it might endanger the continuation of AA as we know it? And he didn't blink an eye. He said to me, the God business. He said, because the zealots, you know, the religious, the true believers, they're, it's very important that they be in charge and they decide who's going to speak and who's going to be an officer. And that's the biggest change in 46 years of going to AA that I've seen. It's become much more doctrinaire, much more religious, much more conservative. But that's true of all organizations over the course of time. They become, and I just tune it out. I go to one AA meeting a week, and the reason I go, because I get less and less out of it, is I don't want to find out what's going to happen if I don't go. And I'm an investor my whole life. You don't make a bet that if you lose, you're going to be wiped out. So I go to AA, well, just for many reasons, and I agree with the person at the front end of the show. I think the fellowship, the camaraderie, the love, the affection, the attention, the sort of being part of a group that has a universal purpose of not just stopping drinking, but learning how to really put a life together sober. You know, I have four kids, four grandchildren, very, very successful life. I live in Paris half the year. I owe my life to AA. But, you know, I go just because I do, and I want to be a sort of a power of example to other people, perhaps in their 20s or 30s, who are looking forward to a whole life without alcohol and what they could might do with it. So I think AA at some point in time over the course of the years is going to become like blue states and red states. There's going to be blue meetings and red meetings. The blue meetings, very liberal, do what you want, take it cafeteria style. However you get sober and stay sober is your business. The red meetings, you got to read the book, you got to do the steps, you got to have a sponsor. What church do you go to? Are you praying on your knees? The more conservative. And that's my guess.
Eloquently stated. Al, thank you very much. What do you think of that idea, Brendan, of AA moving toward red states and blue states, red meetings and blue meetings?
I think that's very perceptive, and it brings up something, a memory I have. I attended open meetings here in the New York area for quite some time to understand the organization, and at one, I heard from an AA member who was talking about he'd recently moved to New York and had just been starting to attend meetings here, and he said he enjoyed them much better because down in his hometown in the Deep South, part of the ritual in AA was for everyone to say before they spoke, "Hi, my name is so-and-so, and I am a sinner," whereas that would never be done at a meeting in New York, I believe. So I certainly think that's a very perceptive comment. It goes back to the open-source nature of AA in that pretty much anyone can found a meeting, and they really do vary by region and by who's leading them.
Let me just do a little bit of brain science before you go. And I think this has been a fascinating conversation. I mean, we've heard from people sort of all over the map with AA, and I think we've gotten to a lot of the core of why it has persisted for 75 years, as that's the inspiration for this segment. AA is 75 years old now. Some of the limitations, some of what works, some of the politics of it. But again, writing for Wired magazine, the Wired take on this is that you get into some brain science and theories about why the method works related to that. The prefrontal cortex has something to do with this?
Yeah, absolutely. Alcohol severely damages the prefrontal cortex, and this is the part of your brain that is charged with regulating your behavior. This is what sends signals to other parts of your brain saying, you know what, like this is something that we need to stop doing right now, and makes that message effective. In the brain of an alcoholic, that cortex is so damaged that it can't send those signals to stop. And so the alcoholic may have an awareness, a total awareness, of the pain they're causing and the damage they're doing to their lives, they can't stop because their prefrontal cortex is so damaged. And essentially what the group does and what the room does is act as a surrogate prefrontal cortex for the newly sober. It basically emphasizes the message of you have to stop in such a way through this external mechanism of people encouraging you and supporting you that you're able to overcome that damage. And as you're in the group and becoming sober, your prefrontal cortex eventually mends. And that may be an explanation for why some people go to meetings very, very frequently at the beginning of their sobriety and kind of taper off as their brain actually heals itself once alcohol has been removed.
Brendan Koerner, contributing editor at Wired Magazine on AA at 75. Great conversation. Thanks to you and thanks to our callers.
Thanks for having me.